Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show by deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm looking at the gods, heroes, monsters, and other mythological beings in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we are continuing our journey through the Indian Mythos section of Deities and Demigods, and we're going to talk about two very important deities. One, Agni, the god of fire, and one, Kali, the goddess of, among other things, time. Let's start with Agni. Now, you will notice that I say Agni and not Agni. This is based on the phonetic pronunciation guides that I've read when reading about Indian myth. They say that the short A, so the A that's in Agni but not in Kali, is pronounced like the vowel in the word but. So basically, it's like a almost like a schwa. So it's kind of a neutral sound, not a. I mean, I could be wrong, but more than one of the books that I've consulted here include that as part of their pronunciation guide. So anyway, Agni. He is the god of fire. Now, gods of fire in role-playing games are typically just associated with what you consider to be fiery qualities. And that is sort of true of Agni, but perhaps we could say that the qualities that are associated with fire are maybe not quite the qualities that you would expect. You know, this philosophy has different ideas about fire. Agni represents not just fire itself, but sort of energy in general. He sometimes represents the sun, he can represent lightning, and he represents fire in the sense of like the animating spark that gives life to living beings. As I was reading about this, I was reminded of the way in which this idea is reflected in popular culture. So, for example, if you watched Avatar The Last Airbender, you will remember that firebenders also control lightning. Even though it's hard to argue that those two are the same thing, but within this schema they are. Also that the duel of the Fire Nation is called the Agni Kai, which is presumably a reference to the Hindu god of fire. His name comes from a root that just means fire, and he's a very kind of a fundamental deity. He is seen as one of the fundamental forces that make up the universe. And fire is seen as a transformative energy. Agni is a messenger god in many ways. And this particularly relates to his role as a sacrificial deity, not that he is sacrificed, but that he receives votive offerings. So you burn things in a fire to send them to the gods, to send them to, you know, whatever other world you want them to reach. And he sort of behaves like a messenger in this respect. And so there's a quotation, I think, from this is from the Rig Veda. It's quoted in Indian Myth and Legend by Donald A. McKenzie, which is actually in some ways an outdated text, but, you know, I'm just quoting the text that it quotes. And it says about Agni, "Thou dost go wisely between these two creations," that is to say, kind of between heaven and earth, "like a friendly messenger between two hamlets." So Agni is seen as connecting the world of the gods with the world of mortals. He's a very important deity in the Rig Veda. We've talked about how, you know, Indra is the most sort of praised deity in the hymns of the Rig Veda, but Agni is not far behind with around 200 hymns compared to Indra's approximately 250. So this isn't the kind of wild, aggressive fire deity that you might anticipate. Instead, he's a mysterious, somewhat capricious fire deity. And there are a number of myths about how he initially is a little reluctant to be responsible for these sacrificial rites. He kind of hides away and has to be kind of coaxed into it, perhaps because of the idea that, you know, he doesn't want to go out. Like he thinks that this will be bad for him, and he wants to be given eternal life. And eventually he's granted eternal life. This, you know, like you, fire can be rekindled after it's put out, I guess is the idea there. He's also a somewhat lustful deity. So there is a myth in which he, you know, the reason that he wants to be like the hearth fires in households is so that he can spend all his time with the ladies, right? Like the idea being that it's sort of the woman of the household's responsibility to tend the hearth fire. And so Agni wants to spend his time like where the girls are. But he's also conflicted about this because, you know, that's kind of part of the message of the story is that this is not a good way to behave. And he's connected to other things that fire is sort of a metaphor for. So like digestion, he's invoked in connection with digestion because the idea that, you know, when you eat food and you digest it to get energy, that's like putting fuel in a fire. The idea of fire as a conduit to other realms is an interesting one, and there are very ancient Vedic rituals that still remain, you know, part of religious practice for many Hindus today, in which offerings are made to the gods through fire. So they are burned in a sacred fire in order to convey these gifts, these offerings to the gods. Agni's share, his kind of favorite offering, is ghee, so clarified butter, and that is part of these offering practices, like a tip for the messenger. The fire can convey things to different recipients, but the position of the fire is important. So where the kind of like the hearth is facing determines where the offerings that are burned in it go. And for that reason, you shouldn't have your cooking fire, you shouldn't have your house's hearth on one of these sacred orientations, which kind of gives you some way of distinguishing ritual fires from, you know, domestic fires, even though the actual structures of the hearths are very simple. Agni, I think, is one of those deities that really illustrates the advantages of using a real-world deity in a fantasy game, because he's so complex and interesting. You would not sit down with a pen and paper and make up a fire deity like Agni. You would start with some kind of relatively straightforward understanding of fire, but the reality is that, you know, in any culture, and particularly in a culture where fire is so central to daily life, fire has many meanings, right? It has great importance, certainly, but it has many connected and interweaving and contradictory meanings. And that complexity is reflected in the complexity of a deity like Agni, which then, of course, is examined and thought about and commented on by generation upon generation upon generation of religious thinkers, so that the Vedic and the later Hindu understandings of Agni may be quite different. Now, unfortunately, Agni's entry in the Deities and Demigods book doesn't really reflect any of that complexity and doesn't reflect his role as a god who sort of communicates between the mortal and the divine. It's basically like, hey, here's the fire god, Flamey McBurnerson, and it's fine, but there's so much more that could be done with him. So I'll leave you with a few quotations from the Rig Veda about Agni. I really like this one. I really like this one. This is 8:19. If, O Agni, thou wert a mortal and I an immortal, I would not abandon thee to wrong or to penury. My worshipper should not be poor, nor distressed, nor miserable. So there, Agni is seen as, you know, giving blessings or doling out luck or prosperity. And there's a very familiar quality to the way that the writer speaks to him. And I think that that's, you do see that in a couple of the hymns to Agni. And I think that maybe the idea there is the familiarity of fire. It's such a central part of the house and of daily life that maybe there's an element of familiarity there that there might not be with Indra. And sometimes he's almost addressed as though he were Indra. So here's another one. This is him, I think, 98. I'd have to look these up. O Agni, overcome our enemies and our calamities, drive away all disease and the Rakshasas, send down abundance of waters from the ocean of the sky. Which is not a quality that you would associate with Agni, right? That sounds like they're talking to Indra, but perhaps what we're seeing here is Agni being addressed in his role as a divine messenger. But that's purely just what I happen to think. I have no evidence for that argument. Now from the fire god, we move on to Kali. Oh boy, this is a complex one. You know, most English-speaking audiences are probably mainly familiar with Kali from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, or from the sensational writing around the 19th century British efforts to stamp out Tuggy. Add to that Kali's fearsome appearance, and you get a pretty understandable view of Kali as a monstrous figure. And she is and she isn't. I don't know much about the early origins of Kali. Just kind of going on this, I'm getting the impression that she is maybe more of a later development, more of a strictly Hindu figure than some of these deities who come to Hinduism with a lot of kind of Vedic background. She is sometimes thought of as one of many aspects of the mother goddess Mahadevi. And she emanated from another one of those aspects, the fierce warlike goddess Durga. And so she herself looks pretty ferocious. She has a scowling, monstrous face. She wields a sword and carries a severed head. She has a necklace of skulls and so on. But she uses her power to protect humanity. So, for example, she's commonly depicted with blood dripping from her mouth, but it's the blood of a demon that she fought. So this was a demon where every time the demon's blood was shed, from those drops of blood, other copies of this demon would spring up. So where's blood fell on the earth that just created more demons. So eventually, in order to defeat him, Kali had to suck his blood out, right? So whenever she would hit him, she would like bite onto the wound and suck down the blood so that it couldn't create any more demons. So despite the fact that she's got a mouth dripping with blood, this is actually a sign of, you know, her being clever and defeating an evil antagonist. She's shown clutching a severed head. This is another demon, I think, and is often interpreted as representing the death of ego. So again, a lot of the time there's a kind of mythological, heroic, cosmic interpretation of these images, and then there's a more complex, not esoteric, but like a more learned interpretation, I guess. And that to me seems pretty typical of the way that actual religious symbology works. Like if you asked a priest about, you know, Saint Michael fighting the devil, they would say that this is an image of the conflict between good and evil that takes place in the world, that takes place inside all of us. Whether or not they thought that there was an actual Saint Michael and an actual Satan who actually fought, they would also think that this represented or embodied that conflict between good and evil. So, you know, maybe Kali is just a cool, heroic deity who fights monsters, but maybe if you ask some wise cleric, they will tell you, actually, this is about the need to destroy your own ego in order to achieve enlightenment. It reminds me a little bit of Mahakala, whose name is not, I don't think, etymologically related to Kali. I think the idea is that her name is Kali, which means time, but it sounds like Kali, which means black or dark, and so they get conflated. But Mahakala's name means great darkness, I think that's right. You remember him, we talked about him back in the Japanese mythos section, although he is interpreted in Japanese art as a much less monstrous figure. He's a sort of demonic-looking figure in Buddhist tradition whose terrifying appearance hides a benevolent nature. And I feel like the frightening iconography serves as a teaching tool. You know, now Kali may look frightening, but according to the Little Book of Hindu Deities, she's responsible for infecting people with diseases, I guess, at a young age so that they don't get more serious infections when they're older, which relates to the idea of something bad happening to you, but that's actually for your benefit, which seems like a recurring theme in the kind of mythology of Kali. You know, scary thing protects against worse thing. Also gives you kind of an interesting view as to, you know, how a deity like this one might relate to their clerics and paladins. Kali is often conceived of as the dark or combative side of the benevolent goddess Parvati, who, of course, isn't in here, so that's annoying. Maybe we'll talk about her at the end of the season. Like I said, she's a time goddess, not a death goddess, but obviously they're kind of related concepts. So she's such a complex figure. You know, she's a protective mother. She's an expression of Shiva's divine power. She's a personification of time. She's a cosmic warrior. And of course, you know, just like Agni, right? Like, that's the nature of these deities. You know, they have complex characters. They are worshipped in different ways. They appear in different myths and different roles. We're used to thinking of things through the lens of a particular interpretation of Greek mythology. You know, here's the sky god, the water god, the fire god, and so on. But for one thing, obviously that's a model that doesn't apply to the whole world. And for another thing, I'm not so sure it applies to Greek mythology that well either. Okay, before we go though, I want to talk about probably the most famous historical connection to Kali that most people know of, which is, of course, the case of the Tugs. Now, I don't know how much you know about Tugs, but if you read British 19th century accounts of the suppression of Tuggy, you'd think that they were a cult who ritually strangled people as kind of offerings to Kali, and who, in fact, justified their killings on religious grounds sometimes. Or at least partly. Because even the British colonial authorities considered Tugs to be the same kind of thing as dacoits, who were bandits who just kind of lived openly as bandits and robbed people and extorted merchants and so on. So Tugs were seen to be a type of bandit, but because of this religious aspect, there were often kind of particularly sensational and gruesome stories about Tuggy circulated. And of course, the Tugs are the origin of our word thug to mean, you know, a violent person, a criminal. But so they're supposed to be these kind of cultist stroke bandits who strangle people with a particularly with a kind of sash or scarf called a rumal. And it will no doubt astonish you to learn that many of these stories are, according to modern scholars, a little bit exaggerated. Well, sort of. I don't know to what extent there is a solid modern consensus. It seems like something where there's actually a lot of disagreement about exactly how much the sources reflect reality and how much the image that we can get from the sources looks like the kind of popular sensationalized version of the story. So even without a secure modern consensus, I think the general view seems to be that the Tugs were bandits who preyed on travelers and who killed and robbed them, and who had some beliefs about how this was religiously okay. But maybe not that they were motivated by religious concerns, or even that they were some kind of fanatical sect of Kali worshippers. It's certainly surprising that a fanatical sect of Kali worshippers would include so many Muslim members. Something like a third of convicted Tugs are Muslims or something like that? I don't know the exact numbers, but that would certainly suggest that they're not being driven by religious fanaticism. In fact, I think gangs of criminals having patron deities or specific religious practices or myths is not that uncommon around the world, and it's a far cry from a secretive cult murdering people for religious reasons. Which is not to say that, you know, murdering people's not bad, right? Obviously, Tugs were bad people, and the innocent travelers of India's highways and byways were better off without them, but they were perhaps not quite as exciting as they were described, and a little closer to just, you know, regular criminals. With perhaps a surprising level of callousness toward the value of the lives of their targets. Most bandits are content to extort money with menaces rather than just murder everybody. But, you know, so in that sense, they're unusual. And I don't know the difference in motivation would matter that much to you if you were the one being strangled with a Rumal and having your body thrown in the river. But, you know, the reason I brought this up is twofold. First, because Tugs are one of the things that, you know, is most associated with Kali in popular culture. But secondly, because it's something that you don't see very much in fantasy games, but that's very common in real life, which is that the good guys and the bad guys, right, the criminals and the victims, are adherents of the same religion and justify what they're doing with reference to that same religion. The mafia, the cops who try to arrest the mafia, and the victims of the mafia are all good Catholics. I mean, for various definitions of good, but they certainly all think of themselves as Catholics. They are all members of the Catholic community. And a look at the real world will show you that criminals are as religious as anyone else, and that crime syndicates often use religious imagery. Again, an example would be the use of the images of saints in mafia initiation ceremonies. Now, you might argue that the destruction of those images is sacrilegious, and maybe it is, but I think that the use of that religious imagery is used to give the occasion a sense of importance because those images are important to the people participating in the ritual. But you very seldom see that in a fantasy game, right? Instead, what you get is, you know, insofar as there are bandits, they worship an evil god, or they worship some kind of bandit god. That's even the case in Glorantha, where a lot of outlaws, because the gods embody the social order, to be outlawed from your tribe or your clan may put you outside of that god's protection, and even you could lose access to your god's gifts, and therefore signing up with the outlaw god, Gagarth the Wild Wind, is very tempting. But that's not really something that happens very much in the real world, I don't think. I guess what's missing is the explicitly fantastic element where, you know, lawful good gods might take action against criminals, might take action against people, especially those who abused their names. So it's a tricky one. I do like the idea of, we know that there were certain victims who were considered to be off limits to Tugs, although I don't know how those rules were obeyed in practice, in the same way that there are, like, supposed to be all these rules for the mafia, but there's no evidence that they're really all that followed. But I do think that, like, claiming to have a code helps crooks who prey on the defenseless feel a bit more like romantic outlaws. That's probably the main function of these rules. But this idea that they're like, you can't kill a holy man, like, it's okay to just kill some merchant, but it's not cool to kill a pilgrim or a traveling priest or a child or wandering musicians are off limits in some accounts of the rules of Tuggy. So I do like the idea of, like, bandits capturing the player characters and being like, ah, yes, well, now obviously we're going to kill these fighters and rogues, but you're a bard. You know, we would never touch a hair on the head of a bard. So throw the rest of them in this dungeon, but this bard can come and, like, feast with us. And then that gives the bard, like, an opportunity to get them all drunk and let the rest of the party out of the dungeon or whatever. So I think, you know, that idea of having certain kind of taboos, even for the bad guys, is fun. Especially if you have a bad guy NPC who's very attached to their image as a romantic outlaw. That's actually in Land Rampant the Crusader States, not in a part that I wrote, but there is a character, Hasan al-Suluk, who thinks of himself as a romantic outlaw poet, even though he's just, you know, a big bully terrorizing a region, and doesn't like it when he is confronted with the reality that, you know, his actual career as a criminal and his pretensions to Robin Hood hero status are brought into contrast. Okay, that's about all the time that we have for today. In our next episode, we're going to be continuing our journey through the Indian mythos section, and we're going to talk about Kartikeya, and we're going to talk about his peacock, and we have some time, we're going to talk about some more deities from Indian mythology. So I hope that you'll join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.